social structure and health. And I have joined this conversation late in a long series of papers and essays that he's written on it. And I'd like to begin with an image from my colleague Eileen Crimmins, who studies this social scientist, demographer. And this just shows from the United States the extraordinary differentials within a broad range of poor versus non-poor. The solid lines on the left are the poor with three health risk indicators. The open circles are no health risk indicators. And then the two curves on the right are survival curves of non-poor. So there's a 20-year differential, no matter how you count it. And this is an extraordinary piece of human biology that I broadly interpret in terms of inflammatory load. First question I'd like to address is how deep is the demographic evidence for SES lifespan? And as everybody knows, national population data didn't exist except for Sweden in the 18th century, but there are a few cities, Geneva being one, where there is some data stratified by professional occupation. And here it's very clear for males and females that there is also a huge differential at a time when lifespans, life expectancy was 30 to 40. So this is, I think, a long-standing feature of human populations, and a glimpse of this even comes from Pliny's observation 2,000 years ago, talking of his summer household up in the Apennines. My servants are healthier. I have not lost a single one I've brought with me compared to pestilential Rome. So this is longstanding. There is likely to be have been an underclass with worse health than everyone else as long as complex populations have existed. Fast forward to our era, we've enjoyed this remarkable increase of lifespan on the average of 1 year per every 4 years of historical time. I've taken Jim Vopel's now canonical diagram and imposed a template of changes that I think are most relevant. And this change began with improved sanitation and nutrition. And of course, we're in phase three in a changing world, and the question is, where is this going? It's worth taking a look at the mortality curves that underlie this remarkable demographic transition. And this is work that I've done in collaboration with Eileen Crimmins and a postdoc, Hiram Beltran Sanchez. Essentially, in the last 200 years for all industrializing populations, the mortality curves have dropped down. And one on the left is the Swedish population from 1750 to the present. And so the gains in lifespan have been due to improved mortality at all ages, but particularly at the early ages. But I want to point out that as these curves drop down, they may be approaching a lower limit, because at the present time, in the best populations, the mortality between ages 10 and 30 is 2 per 10,000. And that cannot conceivably get much lower. And since that seems to set the positions of the curves that have determined our increases in lifespan, I think we can ask the question, have we approached a limit? There's a lot of calculations that can support that, but I just wanted to put that in the air. And our Eileen and I have developed a broad context for this, that essentially the historical increase of lifespans means that aging is slower in accompaniment with driven by the reduced inflammatory load, because infections and inflammation promote the major conditions of aging, including immunosenescence. We have constructed a diagram of pathways of external and internal, and what we did not put into that is the ecological and social. And I've drawn these in here, and I want to emphasize our awareness that throughout this matrix of interactions from ecological to morbidity, causes outcomes of morbidity, there are remarkable gender differences that have emerged. And essentially, these gender differences have emerged in our interpretation in the last 130 or 140 years. It is, if you chop plot the rate of mortality at age 40, the rate improved faster for women than it did for men after 1870, and that's shown on the right-hand panel with this sharp dip. So we have a new domain of human biology here, essentially, with the growing asymmetry in survivorship after the age of 70, which is leading to centenarians numbering our population 3 to 1. Now, just to give a glimpse as to the biology that's behind this inflammatory hypothesis, everyone is aware that atheromas in our blood vessels are full of inflammatory cells and proteins. And I'd like to point out that this is also true for the senile plaques of aging and Alzheimer's disease. Essentially, there's a common set of inflammatory mechanisms that interact with gene risk factors for heart disease and Alzheimer's disease, such as APOE4, and are sensitive to environment and nutrition relatively coordinately. So there's an inflammatory process that we think is a core function of aging that is interacting with our environment and driving these remarkably plastic changes in lifespan. Now I'd like to shift to the part that Bert Singer would give, and I draw here on a series of papers and analyses which initially started with the MacArthur Successful Aging Study, in which he followed a number of markers that are now conventional, but I'd like to just make a comment that I anticipate these will be greatly supplemented by new proteomics analyses, which are somewhere in the pipeline, that will allow us to follow thousands of individual proteins for their levels in oxidative state in an automated way. And this will give another set of levels of our correlation analysis with outcomes of aging and risk factors and morbidity. And that is below the surface, but it's coming, and it will be defining the next generation. So Bert has done a number of different studies, and essentially the more you are in extreme values of the conventional risk factors, the higher morbidity risk for heart disease, diabetes, obesity, and so on. And I'm on thin ice in saying anything about Bert's analyses, but I just would like to point out one of his technologies, which he refers to as recursive partitioning. He's written a book on that. Applied to the MacArthur study, he identified combinations of biomarkers that identify high-risk pathways, and one of the most relevant conclusions for my perspective is that inflammatory markers were prominent in the highest risk pathways. Now, I'd like to turn to his remarkable work that's not as well known as it should be on the Wisconsin Longitudinal Study. These are two papers that are not in major journals but have very rich content. And this, essentially, the Wisconsin Longitudinal Study is a 1939 birth cohort of high school grads, random sample of 10,000, which are being followed longitudinally. There's a huge amount of data besides the usual demographics of health and income on personal relationships, community activities, hobbies, and the biomarker sample was instituted in 1997. And what Bert and Carol Riff have analyzed is the health trajectories by a combination of pathways that are defined by relationships, which I'll say, and economics. So the relationship profile is defined as a negative pathway or a positive pathway. Negative pathway is uncaring or abusive parents when growing up, and or poor relationship with significant other in adulthood. Positive, at least one parent was caring and good relationship with significant other. So here is a really interesting conclusion that in the negative pathway, there seems to be a worse morbidity profile for men, for women than men, but on the positive pathway, they both seem to be relatively equal. Then we combine these two. The economic pathway is the first plus is above or below the median parental household income in 1957, followed by above or below the median personal Wisconsin income at age 59. So you have these different combinations. So the take first the negative relationship pathway with the different economic pathways, and essentially the economic pathway shows benefits progressively over a twofold range. Now here is the most interesting part of it to me that should be better, more widely known, and that is on the positive pathway, the economic loading factors have relatively modest effect. Bert says with positive relationships across life, health is less dependent on money. If you have good relationships, you don't need anything in your pocket. That is, I think, a conclusion that is a hypothesis, but it just brings up the complexities that we need to deal with that are not accessible in many of the conventional large population studies where we don't know the family background. So that ends Bert's segment. Let's see where I am on my time. Okay. So I'd like to now talk more about broader biological questions. And I'd like to just make the point that in the Darwinian context, health may be defined by reproductive success, which is the net population growth at whatever level of mortality. And natural populations, of course, are loaded with infections and injuries that we would consider unhealthy in domestic animals. But the term health really would, I think, is very fraught when you try to apply it to natural populations in the wild, whereas in our context, health is straightforward to define, at least at young ages, by not having infectious disease and by normal growth patterns, or optimal growth patterns. But here, shifting to the domain of later ages, I think we are in a struggle to define what we mean by healthy aging, because everyone has some degree of arterial disease. And the risk of cancer, diabetes, obesity, Alzheimer's increases with advancing age. So I don't propose to discuss what we how we should view healthy aging, but I'd just like to make the point that we need to think in different ways about it, and the Darwinian context is helpful because it's clear that we are no longer in a Darwinian context. So just to make that point, pre-20th century infections were the cause of more than 70% of deaths in populations. Today it's less than 5%. Life expectancy is more than doubled. Chronic conditions certainly existed, but we don't know their level of impact in contrast to current age 50 and over. And of course, our reproductive strategies are totally different
higher education, higher income, family size generally shrinks, and our food resources from going from scarce and irregular now are in general excess for our energy needs. So I think we're in a post-Darwinian context where the forces of natural selection that shaped our genomes are really under very, very much smaller activity. So I'd like to now turn to my colleague's work, Hilly Kaplan, to make a point or two in specifically about what I've just said. And I feel strange telling the story of, that Hilly would tell if he is if he was speaking. I am part of this project in a discussant way and have been privileged to be part of the data analysis. So the Simon A that Hilly and Mike Gervin study are forager farmers in the Bolivian Amazon with life expectancies of about 42 years until recently and high infant mortality. And infections are a major cause of death. And I would even say that in the traumatic associated deaths, septicemia is likely to be a factor. You can hopefully comment on that. The Chimane carry higher inflammatory loads. These are the pink lines for CRP and IL-6. They have frequent acute infections. Their white blood counts are about 10,000 WBC per cubic centimeter, which is at the top of the range for the U.S. norm. About 50% of them are anemic, and they carry an average of 1.3 parasite species per stool. Yet, they are thriving in an evolutionary perspective with a lifetime average of 9 births per woman. So you would have to say that they are evolutionarily successfully adapted to this high infectious load that would be qualified them as being, majority of them as being immediately clinically treatable, just to show that we've got this in our genes. So I'd like to then briefly turn to a broader comparative perspective. Just to point out that the parasitic load of the Simon A in their situation with limited access to modern medicine would be typical in many parts of the world. In an Ivory Coast village, more than two people, 77% of the village carried more than two species of parasites. And it's interesting to look at the number of stool samples that were collected that had no parasites. In the Simon A, it was 27%. In the Ivory Coast, it was 3%. And then, in the, summarizing three different studies from baboons, the figures on the bottom more or less map into the range of the two human populations above. So this was, I think, a general feature of living in equatorial worlds, and I wish I knew of such data on intemperate zones, but I'm not aware of it. So from the next set of questions that I've looked into was, how does the parasite load compare with physical condition in natural populations of baboons, and it's clear that there is an association of the richness of the parasite load with the apparent physical condition. But I thought it was quite remarkable in this paper that parasite richness was not associated with dominance rank, and I don't know how broadly that conclusion can be drawn. Hopefully that'll come up in discussion. Now, an absolutely remarkable observation in relationship to social status and health comes from this paper from people who are in this room, and Altman in particular. And the remarkable observation is that high-ranking male baboons show essentially twofold better wound healing. And this is remarkable because they also have higher glucocorticoid loads, which in many contexts is considered immunosuppressive. But here, whatever additional factors allow that suppression to be relieved. In looking into the number of different mechanisms that could be operating here in the alpha baboons, it's behavioral down to molecular biology has to be considered, and it is clear to me as a physiologist that we have the most insufficient understanding of the different pathways that are at work in allowing this faster wound healing. And lastly, on this excursion of my presentation, I'd like to bring up work that Joan Silk and colleagues have done, which is to show that survival of adult female baboons is strongly influenced by the strength of their social bonds. And I understand there's some new further data that supports this. So the observation of social status and health outcomes in human populations has a deep evolutionary counterpart, and it's certainly not an outcome of 20th century improvements in longevity. I'd like to close by looking at what's happening in the future. Is this increase of lifespan likely to continue? On one hand, we have expectations for major advances, further advances in medicine with regenerative medicine and regenerative treatment for organ damage, and expectations of new drugs that will be tailored to our individual risk profile. On the other hand, I think we acknowledge that there are a number of changes that are anti-longevity. There's a growing obesity epidemic, and I'm particularly interested in items 2 and 3, growing air pollution and increase in inflammagens in the environment. Fossil fuel consumption is slated to nearly double in the next 20 years around the world. And in addition to that, we have other sources of inflammagens, dust from deforestation. The fossil fuel story is really huge because particles from combustion engines interact with obesity, they interact with brain development, and they interact with brain aging. That's work that I'm involved with. And on top of that, we have global warming, which is increasing ozone, increasing urban temperatures, and increasing the difficulties of getting water for agriculture and hygiene. We treated some of these in an essay editorial piece that just came out in Gerontology, and I'd like to point out something that is embarrassing for all of us in this room. As privileged health elite and protective environments at work and home, we will continue to have access to top medical care and experience minimal effects of environmental deterioration compared with the rest of the world. This message is further supported by a UN governmental panel on climate change that just came out last week, which makes the point that the poor side of our human populations is likely to be more damaged than others And particularly wage-dependent poor households will be affected due to food price increases as agricultural production apparently is continuing to decline. That is all I wish to say.
Thank you, Jeff.